And I honestly fell to my knees in this house and just shouted, please give me something. Give me something. And I was still drinking at this stage, you know, although I was aware, which I think is always the biggest step, the first
huge step.
But I just, you know, I dropped to my knees, please give me something. I wanted the phone to ring. I wanted something to happen. Nothing happened. When I started stripping away the drink and everything else and all the other substances, drugs and what have you, you know, it was almost like the universe, it was like the clouds opened and it went, I can see you now. And when you start investing in yourself, it starts to give you something back. And the more you invest in yourself, the more it gives.
I'm Paul Scolfort, and this is Powerful. In this series, I come clean about my own sobriety and the journey it took for me to get here. In each episode, I will speak to a special guest about their addictions and how they achieve sobriety and how they maintain a happy lifestyle today. Today, I'm super excited to welcome Ollie Ollerton on the show. He's a former Marine, SAS soldier, and in the SBS. You might know him from being on the program SAS Who Dares Wins. He's also an author of 5 books and is the CEO of Breakpoint and Battle Ready Academy, 2 really strong physical and mental training academies. So in some of these episodes, there will be discussions of alcohol misuse, drugs, sexual abuse, suicide, and some other heavy topics. So please take care when listening. Ollie, thank you so much for coming to This Is Powerful podcast. I have many questions and I really appreciate you being here, mate.
It's a pleasure to be here. I know we've been trying to do this for a while, but it's something I've been very excited to come on because I've been watching your content. And I did meet you a few years ago, but had no idea of your journey. So
yeah,
I'm enjoying this as much as you will.
Thank you, mate. I appreciate that. For our listeners, I'd love to go back to the beginning, where you brought up and how you see your childhood. And do you see it now different from when you was a child?
That's a really good question. I think we all see it different because at the time, you know, it's like, I think life is a brilliant teacher, you know, as long as you can look back and reflect. And there's a lot of lessons that I've learned and I'm still learning from, you know, and this is where I think a lot of people have got it wrong because they don't use their experience to then be the dictator for the future, you know, the positive lessons, the negative lessons. And really for me, I mean, I talk a lot about this story because I have this statement, and what truly defines you in this life is rarely chosen. You know, it's not the things that we choose to do, it's the things that happen to us along the journey. And that's, you know, when we come up against challenges, when we come up against things that we don't desire, they're the things that make us really grow.
If you're awake and if you see them.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And this is the problem. You know, you look at people in general and they have a negative experience. You imagine a relationship or something like that. And they just say, I just want to forget it. You know what I mean? Or they have a positive experience. Oh, that was a coincidence. They just brush it off. And they don't realize the synchronicities, the power in the experience and the power that's just been delivered to them, the teaching that's been delivered to them. This is why people go from one relationship that's bad to another relationship that's bad. But anyway, my life started at 10. And when I say that, that's my first memory of life on this planet. And that was because of the, you know, I talk about it a lot. A lot of people know the story, but for those that don't, I was attacked by a chimpanzee at the circus when I was 10 years old. And I can sit there and smile at that now because it's a crazy one that I sit there and go, I'm pleased that the experience happened to me because, again, it's all about having life experience. And really, when I look back at that, you know, I was 10, I was at the circus. I was somewhere I wasn't supposed to be. And it's just when the circus was setting up, I lived in a place called Burton-on-Trent in Staffordshire. And I was there with my brother and his best friend. I was the youngest of the family. There was me, my brother and sister. And I got down there, we looked around and, you know, they were just setting up. You know, it's 1980. You could actually walk around a circus with wild animals.
I remember very well.
And it's funny, you know, I tell this story a lot, you know, of talks and everything else. And I always say, you know, we used to get excited about circuses. It was 1980. Yeah. And we used to get excited about that stuff those days. Somewhere I shouldn't have been. I went to the back of the tent, went through to this area that was closed off. And there was a baby chimp sat there. And for me, that was a little piece of Hollywood because I was so in love with Tarzan at that age.
And it was good then. The original one was really good.
The original one with Johnny Wiseman.
Yeah.
You know, speeded up in the water and all that, you know, times 3. Looked like a motorboat. But that was like a little piece of Hollywood. That was Cheetah. So I was so compelled to go and see this thing. I was brought up with cats and dogs, but this was a baby chimp. And before I knew it, stood over it, looked down, looked at me with these beautiful big brown eyes. And that's when time stood still. You know, it was just me, this chimp, beautiful blue sky. And it was an incredible moment. I can remember that. Then the chimp goes down to the floor, picks something up, passes me something. I realize it was food. I'm now baby David Attenborough. And it was an incredible moment. Like I say, it was timeless. You know, it's probably going on for a minute or so. You know, this chimp was going down to the floor, picking up the food, passing it to me. I wasn't eating it. I was sliding it down my cheek because I didn't want to break the serenity of that moment. It was incredible. So I'm sliding it down my cheek, throwing it over my shoulder.
Which is very mindful of a kid at 10, actually.
It is, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think it really is. So, yeah. And then, but it was, I just wanted to exploit that moment as much as possible. And then that serenity was broken like a fighter jet cutting through the sky, or as ferocious as, but not as quite as ferocious as the roar I heard. And that was the mummy or daddy that saw me as the threat. And rightly so, came at Mach 10 towards me from the shadows of this trailer that was behind. And in that moment, I was stood there with my feet glued to the floor. I couldn't move. And when I finally plucked up the courage to realize I needed to get out of there, this thing pounced through the air, went over the chimp in front. The blue sky turned to black, and it landed straight on my chest. It pinned me to the floor. And that's when the first fist came down, knocked everything out of me. I had nothing left. Mm. And it was fist after fist after fist. It was like a drummer in the rock band. In a rock band, I was the drum. And it was in that moment, I remember the moment very well. And I looked through my fingers, and I could see as I was trying to protect my face, and I could feel the skin being torn from my arms and blood flying around everywhere. I could see the blood in its teeth. And
was that from biting or clawing?
It was biting. It was both, to be honest. Yeah. But you know, it was doing both. It was just going crazy, nuts. Mental, yeah. Absolutely mental. And it was that moment where all I wanted to do was lay down and die. Not die, but I just wanted to defend myself. You know, I didn't want to up the ante, didn't want to do anything. I'm just going to accept this and see where it goes. But if I'd have done that, I wouldn't be here today. And my life flashed in front of me. I was 10, didn't take long.
Yeah.
And but in that moment, it was this voice, it was this something that said, it doesn't end today. And I went to a place that I had no reason ever to go to before. It was the first time ever for me, a place I never knew existed. And that was the place that gave me the courage to retaliate. Mm-hmm. And I managed to dislodge the chimp enough to get my knee up to my chest. I smashed out as hard as possible, knocked this chimp to the floor. And that was my moment for escape. And I was scurrying across the floor, realized it was pointless because I just ran out of energy. And I just sat there waiting for this thing just to do what it was going to do. And now, as it raised to its feet, it's all happening really quickly. It came to me at Mach 20 now. It's just going absolutely mental. And I kid you not when I say this, it was an inch away from my nose before the chain caught it.
Christ.
If it wasn't for the chain, I wouldn't be here today, which my ex-wife would be absolutely elated about.
Sorry about that.
Yeah. Sorry about that, love. that was the moment, and that was the start of my life. I don't have any memories before my childhood of that 10-year-old boy. And it's quite an interesting thing for where I'd go later on in life. But before I mention that, I should say that I learned, this is where you say you learn and look at things differently.
Yeah.
And I've been on such a journey that, you know, I later on went and did ayahuasca to actually unwrap that whole experience. And we can talk about that later. Mm. But for me, you know, in hindsight, I learned three things. I learned a number of things, but three main points. And first of all, you know, my business and everything and the concept and the ethos of my life is all about breakpoint. Yeah. Breakpoint is the moment you step into short-term discomfort for long-term gain, which is actually against the programming of who we are, because we're all for the comfort. And we all know you pursue that path, it leads to long-term pain.
Yeah.
Short-term discomfort for me was actually going from this defense mechanism into the attack mechanism and actually retaliating. And the long-term gain of that is the fact to be here to tell the story. The second thing is, regardless of where you are in life, regardless of the situations or the environment you're faced with, you always have a choice, regardless of how dark it is, regardless. And you can probably relate to that.
I can. I read something the other day about buffalo, which I didn't know. It's the only animal beast that will go straight into the storm.
Yeah.
Because it knows on the outside it'd be clearer.
That's part of my presentation. That the rest of the herd turn and they run with the storm, prolonging the pain.
Yeah.
And that's like humans. That's 100%. Exactly like humans. So it's all about being the bison, you know, turn and face your problems, because the longer you procrastinate, the more they amplify, the bigger they become. So
do you know what's really interesting about that? I've read things for a long, long time, but I only found that the other day. I so related to that because there was times in my childhood, I had quite a bit of trauma as well. And I completely could feel when you said about that bit of laying down, because there's been times in my life where I have, very young, and just wanted it to go away.
Mm.
And funny, it's emotional about it, but I wanted it to go away. And but since I feel like I've woken up,
mm.
and I feel everything in my body and my gut feeling, and I know about the bison thing,
yeah.
and I feel that that's me now. I'm like, mm. fuck, we've got to do it, but we're going to do it mm. no matter what. And it's, my friends call me a tea bag because I work well in hot water. So I'm a bit like, probably because yeah. I wore makeup for too long and clothes for a living, but I get a little bit edgy at first. But when mm. I have no choice, mm. I have this deep thing that comes out that I'm getting mm. to really be friendly with, which I think is pretty lucky.
Yeah, it is awesome, isn't it? Because that's the third thing that I learned in that process, is the fact that that inner potential that I know we've all got, that experience taught me to tap into that when things yeah. get really tough, and that will get me through Special Forces selection, which I had to do twice. That's a story in itself. But then also when I was on the brink of, I wouldn't say the brink of suicide, but when I was having the suicidal thoughts far too often, it was the one thing that brought me back from, and understanding yeah. that we've got far more than we're led to believe in the tank.
Yeah.
And it's just, you know, when you look at the whole survival mechanism of humanity, it keeps you below the threshold of your limitations, and that's a survival mechanism. Mm. You know, and it's like, really for me, not only awareness, but understanding the mechanism that we're working with, learning the operating system. People understand their phones better than they understand their bodies and yeah. their minds.
And yeah, literally, and stare at them and know them more.
Mm.
After that incredible experience, in the short years after that, how did that change you? Because I would imagine someone would get night terrors, or they'd become really outrageous in their behavior, or probably retreat. How did it affect you?
Yeah, another good question, because for me, I was just an absolute hand grenade. And to be honest, I mean, I didn't go out there purposely trying to hurt people, or, you know, hurt my parents or anything like that. I just didn't realize I was doing anything wrong. You know, I was doing it quite, you know, because I just felt this drive to really push the envelope in every aspect of my life. I was getting in a lot of trouble with the police, or it culminated with me getting into trouble with the police.
Yeah.
You know, I just lost all interest at school, everything. I just didn't see the point of it. You know, I was good at school. My family was, you know, brother and sister were, you know, did well in school when it came to their education. But I got to a point, I just thought, I couldn't understand why I was doing this, what purpose it held.
Mm.
And I just, you know, I was that typical boy that was staring out the window. And I can remember 14 years old or 15 when it was, Ollerton, stop staring out the window. And I just turned around. It was a maths lesson. Mr. Stanojkovic. I can remember his name, Polish, I think. And I just stood up and I went, I've got no interest in this. It's a load of bullshit. I said, I'm joining the Royal Marines, I can't even say it. I'm joining the Royal Marines.
Yeah.
And he just looked at me and said, you haven't got the discipline to join the Royal Marines. And I was like, looking back now, he was right. But I was going to do it anyway. But what he failed to understand, that, yeah, I did have that pushback against authority and all, you know, the authorities and the figureheads and everything else. I did have that.
Can I ask, think that, that what you said about with the chimp when you was feeding it, you must have had some quite a sort of self-knowledge or awareness, because in school I used to sit by the window too.
Mm.
And I could tell you every license plate, every car, how people was driving. But why that was for me was, I remember asking a question and I got laughed at.
Mm.
And I thought it was actually a pretty good question. And I made a decision, rightly or wrongly, and I think wrongly at the time, I'm not going to ask another question in school.
Mm.
And I kind of sat on my hands about it. I thought, if you're not going to help me, I'm not going to do it. Because I kind of felt that I was in this system at the time. It wasn't serving me. I understand that. I tell my daughters now that what it's about, why you're doing it, what will help you in life, but that's not to shape you.
Mm.
It's just a sort of infrastructure that helps you in this society. Did you see that, or you just didn't like being told what to do?
I just don't. You know what? When I look at it, I was in a very disciplined family. My father was so disciplined. I felt like his employee, not his son.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And I was like, every weekend where our mates from school are playing, we had like jobs to do like you wouldn't believe. And like, I can remember one Christmas, we used to get loads of presents, but I can remember this one Christmas me and my brother got axes for Christmas. We're only kids. And we're like, oh, these are cool. like the proper axes. And like a few days later, we were in the shed, like chopping a mountain of wood. You know what I mean? It was like, so where's Christmas?
Here's the tax you're paying for.
Yeah. You know, and you just had us working as like constantly. Like I do feel to some degree, I mean, listen, there's a line here because I do thank him in some respects because of my discipline. And that was that wasn't from the military. That was from an early age, you know, that I was that discipline. He drove that or forged me into that discipline kind of person that I only kind of benefited from not too long ago. Because for me, as soon as I escaped that, you know, that household and left, I rebelled against any kind of authority massively. Yeah. Even in the military, you know, it's like any kind of discipline. I was the hierarchy's nightmare. I was just against anything. And this goes back to my father. You know, yeah. It's like, it's almost for the first time ever, I could actually kick back and say, no, I'm not doing that. And, you know, if I was told to do something, I'd do the opposite. You know, I was good at my job. I could swim, I could shoot straight and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, but when it came to, you know, I was just like loose. I would go out, I would party, I would do this, that, and the other, turn up late, da, 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 da. And I was just a nightmare to try and contain. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? And I do believe that, you know, that discipline was back then. But you've got to look at the schooling system, right? And I, you know, whether people agree with me or not, this is fact. The schooling system was invented or designed to create factory workers.
Yeah.
You know, that's fact. That's fact. And I'm not going to start mentioning it by... Say again?
20s, around that period.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah. That system, it was designed for that. Now, you've got to look at the school system, right? You go from 45 minutes to 45 minutes to 45 minutes break, 45 minutes, 45, 45. So what you never do is you never do what we are created to do, and that's to get into flow.
Mm.
Okay, you look at you go back in time, you look at like a family of blacksmiths. What did they do? They trained to be a blacksmith. It was drilled into them throughout their whole lives, and they got into flow, they got into passion, they got into love what they did. And that's what we're designed to do. Now, when you're going 45, 45, 45, we become these factory working multitaskers.
Mm.
So you cannot, and this is where everyone's struggling in life, you haven't got patience. This is why you're constantly distracted. This is why you can't focus on anything. And then we've got this thing or gender argument about I'm a better multitasker than you. If you multitask, you are reducing your productivity by 60% thereabouts. Yeah. But that's what the schooling system's done. And really, you've got to understand, you know, that has created who we are today. If you look at anyone that's done really well, an entrepreneur, gold medalist, anyone, a musician, they have stepped outside the schooling system and started to do something outside ours that they are so passionate about.
Yeah.
It's not the school system that took them there. It's the fact, I'm going to run 100 meters every night. I'm going to do this every weekend. And they create and get into flow and they get their dreams. They, you know, they achieve what they want. But if you're just part of that system, you never really train to get into flow.
I totally agree with that. It is interesting when you take a step back and actually look at it, because we, you know, millions of people taught the same thing to do the same thing makes no sense on a huge planet.
Yeah.
Even I started to work in the school holidays when I was 15, doing suspended ceilings with a neighbour.
Yeah.
I got really bored in holidays. I would train. My whole thing was training all the time and running around because I couldn't sit still. And we didn't really have money. So I had this weird thing about, I have a same with my dad. He was really disciplined.
Mm.
And I rebelled against him and had a lot of opinions about him and it and stuff. But I have got into a really good rapport with my father now. He's 84. I know how he works. I delved into his past and he had a horrific upbringing. So I can admire now the good bits of what he's done for me.
Yeah.
I do things differently, but I get it now. And I think that's where my sort of strength comes from as a kid. But
are you the only child?
No, I have a sister.
I think you mentioned that.
Yes, we don't speak though. She's not speaking to me.
Oh.
So maybe after this you will, but yeah, I haven't spoken to her for 5 years. So.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. And how did you do at school?
I didn't perform at school. I left just before I was 16.
Yeah.
But there's a couple of stories I told. I was always intuitive as a child and I felt that I didn't have the vocabulary to explain myself or to say to you, I don't trust you. I know you're saying something different. And it was very kind of, it was a strange upbringing because it was very, it was like a mystery. My grandfather was a mystery. He had a huge IQ, drunk and gambled all the family money away. He was brought up in the East End. Dad followed his dad and ended up working down the docks. And everything, there was no clarity.
Yeah.
And I realize now with my dad, I can see it, I can hear it, that what he tries to do is to make sure everything's okay. So there's no sort of explanation, there's no clarity in what you're talking about. There's no sentences that have a beginning, middle, and end. They're always hung on to like a question mark. Or he'll ask a question with, I'll ask him a question about something and he'll ask me a question back without answering it. It's kind of like, it's a bit like,
asking yourself a question in the mirror.
Honestly, so, so bless him, but I was very confused as a child. All the answers, I had lots of questions, I had no answers to it. And I kind of shut down. And when friends would say, oh, have you heard this song? And they'd recite the lyrics. I'm like, how do you know the lyrics? I wonder where I was. I was almost in fight or flight for a long, long time. So I really believe that I wanted to wake up, and that's my journey. And I give everything to my kids that I didn't have mentally and emotionally, just to give them a real picture. Make your decision, but this is what it is. But yeah, so it was a very interesting, confusing upbringing.
Well, we parallel there anyway, yeah. For sure. I wonder if that had anything to do with the path that we both went on, obviously.
Do you know what? Maybe. I think...
The escape.
Well, it was the escape. And it was. I used to live in a fantasy world.
Yeah.
Because, my dad had a great... he was a big boy. And when he'd come through, you'd watch the dog and the cat go out the back door and you knew that you should follow shortly and come back maybe a couple of hours later when things calmed down a little bit.
Yeah.
But he used to do things to toughen me up. He'd walk me down to the forest at night and just leave me in there.
Really?
Yeah. And my mum used to put me in a drawer upstairs for some weird reason. They locked me in a drawer, locked me in the thing if I was making noise. They do some strange stuff. So to answer your question,
go on. I've got to smile at this because, a carbon copy of me because I had the same thing.
Did you?
My brother and sister locked me in cupboards, locked me in suitcases, chucked me under the bed. I've got a scar here where I managed to let me out. This tall cupboard above the cupboards. I fell out straight onto a Tonka toy. Yeah.
Bloody hell.
Blood everywhere. But yeah.
They were built well.
Yeah. So mate.
Honestly, it's weird because, I can't remember this. It's funny what you said. It's not funny what you said, but when you said about you don't remember before you was 10, I have no recollection before I was 7 when my grandma died. But I used to have a neighbour that would hurt me quite badly. So I used to get, I hate being touched around the head and hit around the head. And I got scars up here where he'd put, this guy used to put me in a box and would jump up and down on it. So I'd get the nail marks in my head.
Wow.
It hung me up with a noose quite a bit. And I do remember the feeling of being suffocated and squashed. So it's a very weird thing, but I'm very good at holding my breath.
Do you ever find yourself in those escape rooms?
Yeah, fucking hell.
Someone said to me the other day, do you want to go to one of those? They've got an escape room now. I was like, are you trying to give me PTSD or what?
I would not be responsible for my actions if I'm quite honest. Yeah, mate. I don't know what would happen.
Well,
but I think that, and I'm not grateful things happen, but it's give me a strength today. But when I found alcohol and drugs.
Which is what age?
So, I first had a drink. I tried a Guinness with my grandfather when my mum was on. We were about 14. I just couldn't understand why
you used to be the age.
Drink it. But around 15 was the first time I got drunk. And it was on a holiday. And weirdly, my dad was a pretty good drinker. And he said to me, watch out for these boys because they're drinking heavy. So don't follow them. So I followed them, drunk as much as they did. Woke up in a hotel room with... I'd put a towel under the door, run the bath, overflowed it, and just lay there in a pair of pants in the cold. Just
wow.
Yeah. And my mum came to a hotel room, opened up, and she's like, what the hell are you doing? I was like, I'm dying. Someone's poisoned me. Help. She's like, no, you're just drunk.
And that was true.
Well, exactly. Yeah. So yeah. She sobered me up. And I didn't drink for the rest of the holiday. I was like, why you would do that? I have no idea. So I kind of weaned myself on after. When did you discover alcohol?
The same age, 14. But the thing is, we lived in a brewery town as well, so pretty much everyone in the local town, they were paid in beer. You know what I mean? I was the youngest of the family. My sister worked in the brewery, and there was always alcohol in the house. You know, it was always there, like Diamond White. Remember that stuff?
Oh my God.
They still do that. I don't know. But Diamond White, my sister loved it. She was had it on a drip.
Right. Literally.
So that's when I kind of discovered alcohol. But you know what? It's interesting because, again, you know, hindsight never won any wars, but it's great for reflection. And, you know, I think this is the beauty of life, being able to analyze the mistakes, the good things we've done in the past, and it helps us to pave the future moving forward, and helps us, you know, especially when your daughter and your family and stuff like that, and helps give them the lessons. But
did that when I first had alcohol, some people say they took it and that was the answer to their life.
Yeah.
I did realize that it took pain away, which I didn't know that was there anyway. It just made me feel really comfortable, maybe a bit heroic. Thought I was more handsome, had a chance with the girls, funnier.
And this is the point I was trying to make, actually, Paul. But I'm glad you butted in because I'd forgot where I was going. But the thing is, right, we use alcohol to mask an emotion, right? So you start off as a young age and it gives you that confidence. You can go and talk to the girls. You can go and do this. You can go and do stupid things with your mates. And it helps you to mask an emotion, you know? But the thing is, and this is why a lot of people, like adults and everything, haven't got any confidence. You know, lack of confidence is one of the biggest issues that we've got in society. Yeah, well, there's a lot of issues, but, you know, lack of confidence is up there. And the reason is because you've always taken a drug to deal with the emotional state. You know, it's like you're renting a personality.
Yeah.
And that's what you learn to do, don't you? So then as you grow through life and you look at drink now, right? Oh, I'm sad, I'm going to have a drink. Oh, I'm doing well, I'm going to have a drink. Someone's getting married, let's have a drink. Someone dies, Sunday. Let's have a drink. It's Sunday, let's have a drink. You know, there's always a reason to have a drink.
Yeah.
And I want to jump onto this now because I think it's a good time to do it. You know, I just came back from Greece and it's the first time I actually looked at people. You know, people seem to think that when you give up drinking, you stop drinking, that you live in a prison.
Yeah, wear sandals and have a tambourine.
Yeah, no, exactly. But you're fighting every day. You know, oh, they must be going to AA and you must be like really fighting. You must see people when they're going out and you must be really like tempted to have a drink and he's just sitting there. You know, that's what they think, like people that don't drink are. But the thing is, it's the reverse. Mm. It's actually the reverse. You know, I would never compromise by having a drink. I wouldn't contaminate the power of this by having a drink. I wouldn't do that. People use it to anaesthetize themselves. But the thing is, I look at people now that drink, especially the ones that drink on a regular basis, I see them as being in a prison cell, but they fucking love it. You know what I mean? They love being in that prison cell. And you look at, right, you look at the principles of Stockholm syndrome, right? Stockholm syndrome, for those that don't know, is when someone, a hostage, falls in love with their captor. They stop trying to assist the outside world that are trying to help them. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And then, they basically form a relationship with the person that's keeping locked in the cell. Doesn't that sound a little bit like alcohol? Doesn't it?
Yeah.
It's Stockholm syndrome. We're in love with this thing called that's really offering us no help whatsoever. And we're not prepared to accept any kind of help from other people that say, just give it a go. But the thing is with telling people not to drink is the fact that you can only tell them so much. They've got to step in and experience it to understand it.
Yeah. It's really interesting because I could talk for ages about, God, you said something really good that I heard the other day about you put yourself in your own boot camp.
Mm,
yeah. Did the same.
Yeah.
Just off my own back. And when I did my boot camp for a year in my apartment, I did so much self-analysis. Now, there's a difference between going to, oh, poor me, this has happened, and just stewing yourself in your juices and turning the gas up.
Mm.
It wasn't that at all. Yeah. I literally wanted to look in every nook and cranny of why I did what I did.
Mm.
Why? What's wrong about it? What's right about it? What pain am I running away from? Mm. What emotions? What thought processes? How do I overcome that?
Mm.
Can I overcome that? Mm. And I literally just read for a year. And I'm dyslexic, like I said, but I bought an English and American dictionary and I read stuff from the 30s about alcohol, all about addiction.
Yeah.
Everything I could read, because I was like, I did look at myself as a kid thinking, you were happy, you were fit, you loved getting up in the morning, I loved the cold, I loved the sun, I didn't care, I did, and it all went, and it was dark, and the last 6 months of my life was literally in a flat, taped up windows, I changed the locks every, I bought loads of locks, changed the locks every couple of weeks in case someone was coming in. Don't know who they were. No one ever come in. I'd got myself into such a bad place. I just didn't know how that happened.
Yeah.
And I always said alcohol is a painkiller. It's been used for that for years.
Yeah.
But I didn't realize that it was an emotional painkiller too. And I always looked at it like I've got a test tube here full of emotions that have just been pushed down and pushed down. I'll deal with that later or whatever. And I've took the lid off. So they're going to come out. What'd you do with that? You know, and that was the final stopping point for me, was how do I deal with this test tube stuff? How was that for you when you stopped drinking?
I can so relate to that. That was a very similar thing to me. And it's like, first of all, I'm sorry, but I'm not, that you went through that, because I think you'd learn so much about yourself in that. And when I got to that point of going into that boot camp, I didn't know who Ollie Ollerton was. I had no idea who Ollie Ollerton was, because the person that was Ollie was always full of drink. And even when I wasn't drinking, you still, you know, like someone that drinks at the start of the weekend, probably drinks Saturday and Sunday. And even if you abstain from drinking in the week, you are still, you've still got the alcohol in you. So then you start drinking on Thursday or whatever, whenever, and you're just topping up all the time. So you become this identity that you create, and you're really stealing away. You become the byproduct. Do you know what I mean? But you then create this persona of this person that really is not you. And I think it gets to a point, probably the same as you, where your soul just goes, I'm sick of this shit. And I honestly believe that this, I mean, the more I've studied it, the more amazing I understand humanity is, how amazing we are.
Incredible.
This system is absolutely, you can't even describe how powerful it is. So once I've started to understand that and really appreciate that, it's made me have a whole different understanding for, you know, the fact I would never contaminate that again. You have to have an element of tough love. You can't mollycoddle yourself through it. You can't sympathize with yourself.
Right.
Because it's like a small child. The more you give them love and wrap them up in cotton wool and this, that, and the other, they'll come back, keep coming back. They want that. But sometimes you just got to be hard. And I deal with myself that way. You know, the TV show is a typical example of tough love. You know, it's not that we wanted anyone to fail. We just wanted to get the best out of people. Mm. It's the only way you can get the best out of people. And like all the time I'm saying to myself, shut the fuck up. You know, do that. This morning, ice bath. It's like, for me, it's like my head is going, you haven't got time. You haven't done it for a few days. You know, and I said, shut the fuck up. Get in there for 4 minutes and shut up.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's that tough love element that really gets you through and starts helping you to get over these addictions, these behaviors, habits, and everything else.
Yeah.
The system's always looking for the path of least resistance, you know, and that's the fact.
I used to live in Los Angeles and I was having a coffee with this really, I love older people. I love just hearing them. And it was just two old ladies sat down and had a coffee. One was a financer for movies and the other one was a financial manager for actors and stuff. And we were just talking and she said, you know what, kid? She said, if you keep cutting corners, you just go around in circles because there's no corners. I was like, that is the best thing I've heard.
I've just stolen that.
Take it. It was genius. And I just thought, she's right. And then she said to me, it was really funny. She said to me, if you want to make it in this town, kid, she goes, you need a really good agent. The other one went, no, he doesn't. She said, what you need is God, because you need that in this town. I was like, fair enough. I've heard some really good things off of older people. What someone told me early on as well was I was having incredibly crazy, intrusive thoughts about your shit. You've messed your life up and stuff. And this person said to me, just stop right there. You are not your thinking.
Yeah.
The first one's going to come in, it's probably negative, but you can change the second one, the third and the fourth. And that stuck by me. I was like, how do you do that? And I practiced that on my own as well for a long time. Just, can you do that? Is that possible? And it was really interesting to get to a point to watch the thought process, but not be in it, you know, because I used to be in it and I would react, especially in traffic and stuff. I'd be jumping.
Yeah, but it's what
car.
You choose to align with, isn't it? You can't, you're not guilty of your thoughts. You're guilty of the actions that you take from the thoughts.
Yeah.
You know, so yeah, absolutely, 100%. But you've got to understand, you know, you've got all this stuff coming in through your five senses, you know, which is creating those thoughts in your frontal cortex. But the more you think a single thought, that actually releases complementary medicine into the body. You know what I mean? And you're creating a biological response through your thoughts. And this is where a lot of people, you know, I didn't realize that an emotion was a chemical reaction. I just thought it was out there somewhere. And when I came back 10 years away, I couldn't get any money for anything. I wanted to start this company called Breakpoint. And I was like, I couldn't get any money whatsoever. And all these doors were closing for me. The usual doors where I'd go to borrow money here, borrow money there, to create this. And I also always, I look at it now as if that was a gift that I couldn't get any money because it forced me into something. And that forced me into this place where I had to do something different.
Can I just quickly ask you, was it because people were shutting the doors because of your drinking and where you were going or your behavior?
No, it's just the fact that I had no credit rating here whatsoever. Right. I wasn't known in this country. So I was coming about trying to get money. But the thing is, I had this history in my past where I would always get money. I'd try and do something, you know, I'd have all these ideas about X, Y, Z, and it would always go down the same path. I don't know, probably spunking a load on going out and this, that, and the other.
Being a legend for 20 minutes.
Yeah, being a legend for 20 minutes, telling everyone what you're going to do and not actually doing it. But the thing was, what it forced me into doing was changing who I was. And then that made me realize that you can't change your environment unless you change the energy of who you are. And it forced me into doing that. Mm. It forced me into meditating. It forced me into visualizing. It forced me into goal setting. Just keep on pushing through, push. And it's interesting, really, you know, and people think, you know, people laugh at, or they use that word coincidence. I've had such crazy experiences in my life that just, there is no such thing as coincidence. And these are the points, these are the things that when these occurrences happen, when you bump into someone on the street, I'm not saying every single incident is something to be analyzed, but you should always analyze these situations. For me, I just started visualizing. I didn't know the TV show was going to happen. I just came back with this dream to start this business, which was all about helping other people, you know, using my experience and everything else. I bumped into my best mate, Foxy, I'd not seen for 13 years, one of the services on the M40, I think it was. And, you know, I hadn't seen him for ages. It was brilliant. We went and got a hotel, got absolutely crazy drunk. And, you know, we came up with these ideas about starting doing something different than the stereotypical version of an ex-special forces soldier going into war zones, this, that, and the other. So I went to this house and I was sitting there every day and I was visualizing this thing called Breakpoint where I'd bring, and I had, this is a vision I had when I was in Australia. I was flying over Australia and I saw it down on the ground below. I saw it happening. And I saw all these people from a corporate entity that were going across this land and they were doing an escape and evasion type thing. Mm-hmm. And I came up with this idea how good it would be to put them through a mock version of SAS selection, you know, from the start when we interrogate, you know, from the physical sort of thrashings, the emotional sort of uncovering their emotional states and then the interrogation. And I dreamt about that every single day. When I say I dreamt about it, I visualized it. I put myself there. I could feel it. I used all of my senses in that moment. Mm. And I did that for 3 months and it was getting towards the end of the 3 months in this house. And there was a second visualization, which I'd be on stage every day. And when I was on stage, I was actually there with Foxy. Me and Foxy joined on the stage and I could feel the shirt on my back, the shoes on my feet, the expensive watch on my arm. It was a total lie to where I was right now, but I could feel that. I could smell it. I could taste the experience in my spit. And it got towards the end of 3 months and my family are like starting to get really concerned because I was in one of my brother's home. He'd gone away to work overseas. And they were starting to get concerned. They were like, Matt, you know, this thing about Breakpoint, you know, there's lots of people doing that. Why don't you go back to Iraq or Afghan, get some more money because we got paid a fortune out there. Get some more money, come back and then start when you've got a bit of money in the bank. They didn't know they were doing me any harm. They didn't understand what happened to me in Iraq, you know, what that self-abuse. But, you know, it was that moment when I started to question what I was doing. You know, all this stuff, this visualization, this meditation, blah, blah, blah. And my head starts going, it's a load of shit. It doesn't work. And, you know, so the seeds of self-doubt started just eating away. And I honestly fell to my knees in this house on my own and just shouted, please give me something. Give me something. And I was still drinking at this stage, you know, although I was aware, which I think is always the biggest step, the first
huge step.
But I just, you know, I dropped to my knees, please give me something. I wanted the phone to ring. I wanted something to happen. Nothing happened. But then 2 days later, Foxy called me. The phone rang. I thought, oh, he wants me down the pub, which I didn't want to do. And these were the words, you know, that idea you've got for Breakpoint, would you do that on national TV? You know, and for me in that moment, I can remember exactly where I was. The hairs on the back of my neck standing now, because they were then. I was like, oh my God. I had no concept that I would be on television. I had no concept that the thing I'd designed in my head would be what you saw on Channel 4.
You couldn't get a better platform.
You couldn't get a better platform. So it was like, it was the delivery from the heavens. Mm. But the thing was for me, it's when I started stripping away the drink and everything else and all the other substances, drugs and what have you, you know, it was almost like the universe. It was like the clouds opened and it went, I can see you now. Yeah. And when you start investing in yourself, it starts to give you something back. And the more you invest in yourself, the more it gives.
You have to put something in to get something back. You can't just sit in your house and not do anything about it.
No.
What? So at that point, you're still drinking. Was that just because at that point you was in a habit and you was just trying to get out of Dodge, so to speak? Or do you think that that was because of, you know, I've never been to war, but I'm sure you can't imagine how, maybe not traumatic, but how much endurance you have to have. And it must be so bloody hard that you need a relief. Do you think the drink carried on to that point because of that stuff? Or,
you know what? I mean, it's hard to sort of, I think you can get in danger sometimes of the witch hunt, you know, for what it is. But one thing I'll say is, like, you know, I don't blame the military. I don't blame anything for where I was. This is how I've analysed it. It goes back to your first question. And that is the fact that, when I look at it now, right, I had that chimp attack at 10 years old. Mm. As soon as I finished, I went, you know, in school, absolute dramas, chasing, danger, this, that, and the other, always pushing the envelope. Then I wanted to join the Royal Marines, okay? I wanted to create this armor around me that was so hard. And I wanted to be at war every day. Mm. So I went to join the Royal Marines, I got all that. And then I got there and then realized, what is this? This isn't what, this didn't, it didn't click, it didn't go, yes, you are now where you need to be. So I went, well, that must be in the special forces then. I'm going to do that. So I then went to the special forces and passed that. And again, same thing. It didn't, like, I didn't pass and then I went, yeah, you know, and I'm, you know, because I thought from the outside looking in, if I get there, that's me for the rest of my life.
Yeah.
But every time I got to these places where I thought I was supposed to be, I didn't feel like I was where I was supposed to be. I didn't understand the meaning of purpose, or that wasn't even in my vocab. And it wouldn't be until years later that I realized that I was chasing a war that wasn't out there because it was in here.
Mm.
You know what I mean? And that's, for me, when I look at it, the trauma I dragged into the Royal Marines. And this is the thing about trauma. We've all had trauma and it's all relative. It doesn't matter. We've all had trauma. Trauma is dangerous when you allow it. Trauma is blocked energy in the body, like we spoke about before. For me, I believe we've got this innate system within us that helps us get over the short-term trauma. And that is a good thing when we can lock away the intimate trauma, push it away. But you're not supposed to leave it. You're not supposed to think that you can get away with it.
Yeah, it just ferments then, doesn't it?
And yeah, it just ferments. Something. Yeah, and for me, you know, it's crazy when I think, because when I did get into trouble with the police, and that was quite monumental, I did it well, and I've just avoided a custodial sentence at 14 thereabouts. I find it bizarre because my dad got a psychiatrist, right? And I look back now, it's only something I've recently realized. And I used to have this psychiatrist every week and everything else. Not once was anything mentioned about the chimp.
That's crazy.
Don't you find that bizarre?
That's very weird.
To not go back to your childhood.
To the obvious.
Yeah. To the obvious thing. It's the elephant in the room. You know, and then they came up with some synopsis that it was because my grandma had died, and it seemed like a lame grasp at give me the bill. Here's the bill. Yeah. But yeah, I find that quite bizarre. But really for me, it was like, it wasn't until I was backed into a corner when I started thinking about ending it all. You know, that was the only solution. Yeah. My life's a wreck. This is just me. But leaving, because the program states that we are a victim of our genes, which is the biggest load of rubbish when it comes to our health and who we are. It was when I realized, when I actually got pinned into that corner, when I realized the drinking wasn't getting me anywhere, the drugs and everything else, the smoking, just the whole disregard for my own self-worth. It was in that corner where I finally sat there and took responsibility.
Mm.
Yeah, we can sit there, we can blame the environment, we can blame all these things that happen in our lives, but where's it getting you? You're there because of your choices. And this is what I was saying in my head. You're here because of your choices and you can do something about it.
Did that just come? This is the thing. A lot of people don't realize that. I experienced that early on as well. But when you know that, what clicked there? Because I'm sure that, well, I'm not sure, but the training you've done is incredible, and the experience you've done, you know, and the SAS and SBS must be unbelievable. So how did you, not wake up, but how did you come to start to see that awareness that you could visualize and meditation and things like that? Because that would seem strange for someone in the military,
exactly,
I would imagine.
And it's the biggest question sort of thing I get. I wasn't expecting that from you. But the thing is, for me, it was a wake-up for me when I actually sat there and started thinking about suicide. At that time in my life, I couldn't actually string a sentence together. It got that bad without a drink. Do you know what I mean? I was only ever confident with the drink. I was only ever who I knew Ollie was with a drink. And for me, when I actually sat there without the drink and everything and started like thinking my life, this is bad stuff, I think I actually then went, hold on a second. You're in the special forces. And it was that benchmark of excellence that I had created once in my life. I realized that if I'd been there before, I can go back there. Mm-hmm. Not going back to the military, but, you know, understanding that I can repurpose those skills. If my skills could get me to be a special forces soldier, surely I could use that. It's the yin and yang of life. And I'd just taken a big dip, a massive dip down over 10 years, abusing myself and everything else. For me, in that moment, I then started to further analyze that and realized, what am I doing then? Because this ain't working. And I realized that I hated drinking. I hated it. It was a long, long battle of thinking, this is not good for you. Internal messaging before, have a drink. External, you know, the day after, what are you doing? It's this constant battle.
It's a battle, literally.
Yeah. And it was, I realized in that moment, I thought, well, how come I hate it, but it doesn't change? How can we hate things and it doesn't change?
Powerful question.
Yeah. And it's like, surely if I hate it, it's got to stop. So I thought, hold on then. So I don't know, like this sort of spirituality, if you want to call it that, at that stage, started coming natural to me. And I started thinking, well, there's a yin and yang. There's a law of polarity in this world. So there's an opposite to what I'm doing. What is that? So I started thinking, well, I hate myself, which is the worst thing you can ever do. I hate my environment. I hate my history. I hate this. I hate everything. What's the opposite? What is the opposite of that? Total opposite. I started to create a picture of the person that I wanted to be. Who is Ollie in 6 months? What does he look like? What would I really, what's he wearing? What's his skin like? What's his body like? And I look into his eyes, is there clarity in there? Is it like bloodshot cartoon eyes? You know, I started to build the picture of who I wanted to be, which was totally opposite to who I was right then. Yeah. What does that person represent? And then I added the cherry on top was, what does it feel like to be that?
Yeah.
And the more I held on to that feeling of what I wanted to be, the more that I would be driven towards that. In fact, as far as I'm concerned, it comes to you.
Which is so attractive and so powerful. And it's really important that people hear that, because I don't believe many people know that that's possible.
Well, they don't. But the thing is, I think that's because they just don't understand the power of this. You know, 60 to 80,000 thoughts a day.
Yeah.
Some people are a lot less.
That was probably me.
Mate, we've all been there. But you can, I mean, probably more, mate. Probably in your day, probably when you're drinking and everything, is it not right to say? Because I was, I reckon it was 80,000 plus.
Oh, 100%. And I used to do lots of coke as well. So I was praying most of the time. Yeah,
absolutely. Absolutely. So you can relate to that. But the thing is, 60 to 80,000 thoughts a day, because our survival mechanism is focused on the negative, you know, it's always about the problem. I look at this, right, because you've been in that world where you see beautiful cars, beautiful women, this, that, and the other. And I think when we look at anything beautiful, it's because we are able to eliminate the absence of any flaws.
That's a very good way of saying it, yeah.
Because when you look at a car, right, that's beautiful, you're searching for where it's flawed. Yeah. You're searching for an issue. You look at diamonds. You ascertain the beauty of a diamond because it's got no flaws in it whatsoever. Yeah. And that's what we do. When we look at any situation, we only identify it as absolutely stunning and beautiful when we can't find any flaws. And that is your survival mind, because it wants problems. It doesn't want just the easy path and this, that, and the other. It wants to find the problem. And when you look at a survival mechanism, what's going to kill me? And that goes down the tiers. You know, we're now no longer with the saber-toothed tiger and everything else, but we still have that primal instinct. So in everything, we can sit there. If we're not conscious of it, we'll look at anything and go, where's the problem? And in the absence of anything that's bigger pulling us through, and I do believe that the answer to mental health and also getting through places that you don't want to be, we should always be aiming for something bigger. And I put this on the other day. What was the words I used? It says, make sure your goals are bigger than your problems. Otherwise, your problems will become your goals.
And I love that.
Yeah.
What, if some people might understand that, what does that mean?
Because in the absence of something that challenges us, like a goal, we get bogged down with the noise.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? This is why, you know, I used to come home from war and my wife would be going, oh, the washing machine's broke, or Mavis over there parked a car across the drive the other day. Get me back to fucking war.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I call that peace in war, because I went back to war. It was black and white. Someone wanted to kill me. I wanted to kill them if they were going to try that. And that was it. It's quite basic, really. And just being in that, it was bigger picture stuff. I didn't have the small stuff. And then in the absence of anything that's big and pulling you through, you get bogged down with the absolute the white noise of life.
Yeah, and that's so clear. Mm. And I know, I haven't experienced it in that way, but I know when I've had stuff going on and the little things, someone's talking about the little things and I just don't have the patience. I'm like...
Yeah, and I think you relate to this as well. I think also, you know, when, because we've all been out not drinking, but you've been to a social environment.
Yeah.
I can't stand the small talk.
I can't do it, actually. It's because I know it's not real. You're just doing there to be comfortable. So, Ollie, Breakpoint.
Mm.
It's a great, I love the, how did the word come around, a sentence? And for those people who don't know, what is it? Can you do it? And what other courses do you have running currently?
Mm. So Breakpoint was, when I look back, that was the first chimp attack.
Yeah.
The first moment of my life. And I, like I said to you, when you start looking after yourself, when you start investing in yourself, the universe starts to say, I can see you now. I'm going to give you something back for that investment. In fact, you are the universe. Mm. But for me, once I started on that path, things started coming to me. Things started coming in. And that was something for me. And the name Breakpoint came to me in the middle of the night.
Right.
And I started to try and fit. What is this come to me? And I started to think, because I was trained as a, you know, like a, trained as a special forces soldier, straight away I started thinking, well, it's a security company. What a great name. And I realized as time went on, I started falling into sort of the premise of self-development and everything. The name then drifted to a self-development company,
yeah,
which is what it is today. And really, you know, we started off doing the physical things that I did imagine in that house and everything, but it's really gone onto a platform now where we've got a virtual platform. I've run courses and it was really getting to as many people as possible. We used to do the face-to-face stuff, but the thing is 25 people over a weekend, they'll change in the short term, but they'll go back into the programming of who they were shortly afterwards. So how can we maintain that traction and keep them on a path? You know, like your life is on a path now. And it's, but once you get that, once you get that traction, that momentum, it sticks and it becomes contagious. You want more, you want more. Breakpoint for me is a disruptive change in habitual behavior in line with a predetermined goal. It's a state of mind. Do you know what I mean? And that's really what it is. I don't own the rights to Breakpoint. We all go through breakpoints throughout our lives. And the moment we wake up, you've just got to look at everything. Everything is steering you on the path of least resistance. It's about having consciousness in that moment, thinking, no, I'm not going to go the way you want me to go. That's the easy way. I'm going to go towards my goal. Because if you've got your goal here, right, and you're on this path and something's taking you off, you've just got to say no to it.
Mm.
No. Why would you not want to do that? And you understand it's just the mind just trying to do what it wants to do. So really, it's a state of mind. Breakpoint is a state of mind. We've got virtual platforms. I've just started to launch an inner circle. So people that I mentor on a constant basis, make sure they achieve their goals, make sure they're authentic to who they are, and make sure that they exploit that self-empowerment, you know, and start to live in the power of who we are.
And did that come around because you know what you've been through and how you've got through it, and you want other people to receive that as well?
Great question. I did that because I stumbled across an experience after the Special Forces, and that was in Southeast Asia, where I went on some kind of moral duty to help these kids that were being exploited into sex slavery in Southeast Asia. I went over there, my moral compass switched on, took me over there. I wasn't being paid, but it was the best return on investment ever. And once I got out there, I realized that I had no idea the gift it was going to give me.
Yeah.
The power of helping other people is something that we all get so much from. And rightly so as well. Of course, you're going to feel good helping our fellow person, a fellow man, a fellow woman. You know, it's innate that we should feel that good. So I learned that from that experience. That ended overnight. We were hunted. There's a manhunt for us. We had to escape. But what I took from that is the power of helping other people. And then going through the breakdown of myself shortly afterwards, those two situations were the DNA of what I created. And Breakpoint is a globally identified brand recognized for the positive growth and development of others. It was through that experience. That was the DNA. And that empowered me to create this thing. you know, and that was the start of it. It was two real things, but that took me on. That's what I want to do. And then the TV show came around and I was like, that's the platform I'm launching from. I never set out to be a celebrity. I've got no, you know, if I treat every TV show like it's the last one, it's not my primary, it's a bit of a sideshow, but I will make hay while the sun shines because of my exposure.
And that's the thing. It's using exposure in a good way. Mm. A lot of people I've worked with always do it just for monetary gain or fame or a seat at a restaurant where they want to sit. And I kind of rebelled against it. But because I had such problems with drinking drugs in the past, this is why we're doing the podcast, just to notify and doing the charity. Someone said to me early on, if you want self-esteem, do esteem with wax.
Yes.
But, okay. Fair enough.
I like that. Say that again for me.
If you want self-esteem, do esteemable acts.
Yeah.
You know, helping other people.
Yeah.
And I never really understood that before.
That's incredible.
Ollie, I'm gutted. We're out of time.
Yeah, we are out of time. But that's a shame. We can do another one.
Can I just ask you one question?
Yeah.
I always ask people, if someone's on the couch at home, if their mindset's really negative, they're drinking or they're drugging, they don't know what to do, what's the first step?
The first step is to understand that you can change. Have belief, or not even belief, forget belief, right? Because everyone's out there saying you need belief, this and that. Start to create the vision of who you want to be. And then, as long as you put enough passion and enough emotion into that, you know, a positive direction with a positive emotion will get you to it. But the fact of the matter is, instead of thinking, I'm a victim of my genes, this is who I am, all that stuff, becoming very insular, just understand you can change. Secondly, change the pattern of your routine straight away.
Yeah.
Because at the end of it, you know what it's like, you become very insular, you don't want to step outside of your normal routines, you become so tight in that. And really, at the end of the day, we have got this amazing complex system. Do you not think it's got a mechanism that tells you when it wants to change? That's what I call depression. And really, it's like a, you know, when you...
Road signs.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, you know, the cars, when they're not functioning right, what do? They go into limp mode, don't they?
Yeah.
We're the same. We're the same. So that for me is when you're feeling that flatness, that depression, that means your brain just wants you to do something different. Your soul is screaming for you to change your pattern of behavior. You know, but it's breaking that chain, which is break point, step into that short-term discomfort, understanding you can get through, but make sure you have a visual goal that you're attached to.
I've got chills. That's beautiful. Thanks, Ollie.
Thank you so much. Appreciate this space.
Thank you. This podcast is brought to you by Stride Foundation. If you or someone you know is struggling with addiction, please head over to www.stridefoundation.com where you can find links to resources that may help. You can also make a donation. Please make a donation. It will help us bring to you more episodes. And if you enjoyed This Is Powerful, please rate, review, and follow the podcast to share it with your friends, your family, anyone you can, and head over to social media. I always love to see and hear how you react to the episodes, and it's so helpful for our content to be shared. Thank you also to my beautiful wife, Dr. Federica and Marty, the best producer, Shannon Delwich, to Henry, you know who you are, and to Emma Long, who does all the hard work in the background. And there's a whole catalogue of episodes wherever you get your podcasts. But did you know you can also watch it on YouTube? Just search for This Is Powerful with Paul Scofield.